Good evening and welcome. It's KBCR. I'm David Fleming. Now, before we get to the program, a reminder. Coming up in the second week of December, KBCR will once again be partnering with Feeding America Riverside San Bernardino for our Feed Your Radio, Feed Your Family campaign, during which we'll be looking for listener contributions with a really nice benefit. Every dollar that a person contributes during this very short campaign means a meal for someone in need here in the Inland Empire. A $50 contribution means 50 meals. A $100 contribution, 100 meals. It's as simple as that. Once again, this short drive is coming up in the second week of December, and we'll have further reminders as we get closer. Now to KVC Arts. Tonight we're going into the KVC archives for a conversation with David Foster. He's given us so much in the world of music, songs, and singers, and put it out there in his book, Hitman. Lillian Vasquez has more in this conversation from 2009, not long after the book came out, and when we were airing the PBS special by the same name.
What I'd like to do first is go back to the early years growing up in Canada. Growing up where you went to church on Sunday and you had dinner at 5:30. Tell me about your childhood.
You know, my childhood, Lillian, was, it just seemed perfect to me. And every time I think that there was like a chink in the armor, that something wasn't right, I go, no, everything was right. And recently I was together with all my sisters. We were in Mexico together hanging out, and they all had different versions of what their childhood was like. And because I had six sisters, I'm the only boy, I kind of had a little special treatment. Not because of my talent, but because I was the only boy.
By mom and dad?
Yeah, more so my mother. Mm-hmm. You know that, because you're probably a mother mm-hmm. yourself, right? And there's that special thing between a mother and her son. And of course my parents recognized that I had a talent, and they nurtured it in just the proper way without, you know, getting crazy with it. You know, I played organ in the church on Sundays. We had dinner every, you know, the usual, what you would expect of a Canadian family that didn't have much money, but we never felt poor, of course. And grew up on an island, so there wasn't many musical influences for me. So I had to kind of struggle as I grew older and wanted that stuff. You know, I didn't have television. I didn't have PBS. I didn't have public broadcasting, so there was no television. There was television, but just not in our home. So I had to really reach for the things that I wanted to learn about, but I found my way.
Let's talk about your dad. What did your dad do for a living?
My father was a worker at an office, kind of supervising a yard that dispatched equipment for like the municipality to fix the roads and all that. So it was an office job. He worked very hard and was also a musician, an amateur musician, but he taught me how to play stride piano, right? This barroom piano. I still rely on it today. I mean, this influence that he gave me all those years ago, 50 years ago, I still kind of draw on that now. You know, it was an amazing time.
I know your father has since passed away, and you write about him in your book, and you think about him every day, so you say.
Yeah, it's a strange thing, isn't it? You know, I have a friend who just lost his mother, and I sent him a note, and he thanked me for the note because apparently I said all the right things. And what I said is, you lose your mother or your father, no matter what age you are, whether you're 18, as I was with my father, or 56 with my mother, or 80. If you're 80 and you lose your 100-year-old mother, it's still your mother.
Right.
So the loss is just as great. Obviously, the more years you can have with your parents, the better, but, you know, you take what you're given.
That's right. In your book, you also mentioned that you didn't get in trouble as a kid. And from what I could read and find about you, you haven't gotten in trouble as an adult. Working in that mm-hmm. industry, how has that happened?
That's a great question. It sounds like a line you've heard before a million times, but I just never really wanted to disappoint my parents. So the notion of getting high or doing drugs or going on a drinking binge or being with a bunch of women or going to nightclubs or all that stuff didn't play into where I was going because I didn't want to disappoint my parents. So I believe I was raised right. And I had a mission. And like I say in the book, it's not all that profound, but the road to success is straight. It's not filled with curves. And so like I just put these blinders on from as young an age as I can remember, and I went, I want this so badly. I want my name to be alongside all those other names that I see on the back of album covers. And that's how it happened.
All right, let's talk about your first band.
I thought you were going to say my first wife.
No.
Well, that's later, I guess.
We really have, David, to talk about all the wives.
We don't have that much time.
But let's talk about your first band. Yes. Do you remember it, the name of it?
Yeah, we had a band called Skylark, actually formed with my first wife. It was great. We sat around one night. We went, now who would we love to have in a band? We picked some guys. It all came together, and we drove my van down to Los Angeles. We got a record deal.
From Canada?
From Canada. And we got a recording contract with Capitol Records. And lo and behold, we had a hit record, which is like,
How do you do that?
That was Wildflower, it was called.
Wildflower.
Yes. And, you know, my ex-wife, BJ, had had an earlier connection to Los Angeles, and she had already opened a couple of doors, and we were good. I mean, our band was good, and we were unique. We were Canadian, but we had a sound, and we had this great song called Wildflower that our guitarist, Doug Edwards, and a friend of mine who's a policeman named Dave Richardson had written the lyrics to this beautiful song that became a huge hit. And there we were, you know, with a hit record.
You know, when you get as famous as you are and done as much as you've done over your career, it's really nice to read that you still think about your junior high school teacher. Was it Bob Bergeson?
Yeah.
Bob
good.
Bergeson.
You didn't even look down when you said that.
Wow.
Tell me why.
Charlie Rose always looks down.
Does he?
Well,
I've got something over Charlie Rose, but he's in New York. Why did you remember Bob Bergeson? What did he do that changed or had an influence on you that you would think about him when you're writing your memoir?
I like to say, we were actually just talking about it with the fellow that was doing my makeup, talking about school band. School band is so important, and as you know, music in the schools is a dying art, and it's just tragic because it's proven that it keeps kids out of trouble. My years in the school band were amazing because I had a band teacher that allowed me, I thought I was tricking him, but he allowed me to play a different instrument about every 3 or 4 months throughout my junior high school years. But it was so fantastic. And I thought I was pulling the wool in his eyes, like, oh, hey, now I want to play the trumpet. Hey, now I'd like to play the trombone. And he would just go, okay, go ahead. Go ahead, you can rent that one. There's an old one over there, you can use it. And what he was doing was allowing me to learn about these instruments so that when it did come time years later for me to write for an orchestra, that I would have a comprehension of what these instruments could really do. And it profoundly helped me. So he was a big influence on my life.
I want to ask about, well, first of all, I know you have 5 girls. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the first 4 first. Was your daughter Amy, her middle name is Skylark, was that after the band?
Yeah, kind of, I know.
Go with that, tell me about that.
She hates it, loves it. You know, she's now in her 30s, so she's got 2 children of her own. She's a wonderful songwriter. She's, among other things, co-written both of Michael Bublé's hits, Home and Everything.
She has.
So she's very established as a songwriter. Yeah, making a lot of money. Everything's good there. She goes in and out of hating her middle name, Skylark.
But
she
was a great name, actually.
For a middle name.
It is a great middle name.
Yeah, it was very hippie-ish, though, don't you think? But I wasn't a hippie.
I just figured when I saw that, I thought it had to be after his band.
Yeah,
your choice
for
or your wife's choice at the time?
The wife, and the band was called Skylark after a song that the wife at the time, the song's called Skylark, that Aretha Franklin had done and people before. It was an old 40s song, so. That was daughter number one, wife number one.
Yes. Let's talk about your marriage with Linda.
You missed him.
All right. I want to talk about Linda and your marriage, and then...
Is this E-Talk or is this PBS?
Your marriage with Linda and the blended family.
Yeah.
And you mentioned throughout the book how you always feel bad that you didn't do enough for your girls.
Right.
And yet, you know, you talk very well about them. What do you think you were missing, or what did you think you weren't doing right?
Blended families, if you know anything about them, and if you don't, if you haven't experienced a blended family, it's almost impossible to explain. But it's very difficult because you always see the problems with the other children that are not biologically yours. You tend to be harder on them because they're not your own children. It's just a weird psychological thing. You can see their flaws and their faults more than the biological parent can. And that's what happens with blended families. So that means I was harder on Linda's boys than she was. She was harder on my children than I was because we don't see the faults in our own children as much. So it's just a very difficult thing. And my experience has been most of the people that I've talked to that are involved with that have blended families, they all struggle. It's a terrible position to be in, and yet, you know, love is kind of the trump card. So, you know, you fall in love, and then you have to make everything else work. It's just, you know, it's difficult enough in a family unit where everything is biological, but then you add all these other elements, and it's...
Now, you and Linda didn't have any children together.
We did not.
You did not. But from your second wife, you had 3 girls, right? So tell me about your 3 girls.
Rebecca was my second wife, and we have 3 wonderful daughters, Jordan, Aaron, and Sarah, and they're all doing well. I like to say you're only as happy as your saddest child. All my children are doing well. They're all productive and taking care of themselves. There's no trust funds for my kids. There's no huge amounts of cash coming their way monthly. They all work, and I'm not saying I haven't helped them, because I believe that you should try and make it easier for your children if you can, but you give them enough to do something with it and not enough to do nothing with it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of been my philosophy. And in fact, I have in my will that if any of my children get married before they're 25, they're cut out of my will.
Ouch!
And everybody goes, that they go like, whoa, what is that all about? And you know what I say? Hey, it's my money. It's not your money. It's my money. I'm the boss of my money.
That's right.
And that's the rule.
That's your rule.
Well, now my youngest is going on 24, so it's almost a moot point at this point.
So. But, and is she close? Which of them are married? One's getting ready to marry a tennis player?
One is goes with Tommy Haas, a wonderful German tennis player, and they're batting around the notion of getting married, and they've been together 2 years, and they're great. My youngest has a boyfriend. They live together in Switzerland. They're doing amazing. She does marketing for a company in Switzerland. And then my daughter Erin is an actor on television. My daughter Sarah is an actor in movies. And Erin has a boyfriend who's in the music business who's successful. And it's all good, right?
So they're all doing good.
Yeah. And you know, some, and when they're not, you feel every... You have children, right?
I do.
And are they of the dating age yet, or are they...
They are. I have a daughter that's 17, and she is dating.
It's painful, because you hurt
it's
for
scary
every...
scary as all get out.
Well, the scary thing I'm not so scared about. Like, you know the notion of the guy with the, you know, the father with the shotgun at the door. It's like, guys, you got to get over it. You have daughters, they're going to have sex. That's the bottom line. I'm sorry. That's the bottom line. I mean, you can't... You know, I said that to Faith Hill. She went, shut up. But I mean, it's just the truth. You got to get over that hump. Once you get over that hump, then you can relax and, you know.
And in reality, we were young ones. So, yeah. I mean, when I think back, I don't want to think back that far what I was doing. But, I mean, you're right. And she is part of me and she's part of her dad. So she's.
If it's not 17, it's 16. If it's not 16, it's 18. It's going to happen. And you just got to get over that and then, you know, try and educate them properly.
In your book, Rebecca wrote a lovely email to you that I really loved.
I did too.
And it was just so, she had sent it to you for Father's Day, and she was thanking you for being the good father that you were to her three girls.
Yeah. I was blown away by that letter because as parents, obviously, you know, we only do the best we can. You're just not equipped. Nobody can teach you about the corners you're going to turn as a parent. I have so many friends now who have a lot of problems with their children, and you just don't know what's going to come at you, you know? I remember Paul McCartney once said to me, he said, life is like a crap sandwich that you're forced to eat slowly every day. And he was only half joking, because of course life is not that. Life is beautiful. But there are those days when it does feel like that. And to come around to your question, to get that letter from Rebecca was wonderful because I wasn't there physically in the house when my children were growing up.
Because they were growing up in Canada with Rebecca?
No, they were growing up in L.A.
Oh, they were in L.A.
But with their mother. Mm-hmm. And you know what that's like. It's weekends. And also, here's the other thing.
You're kind of busy, too,
yeah,
aren't you?
That's the thing. This is what I've just learned. I don't think it's possible to have a successful career and be a perfect parent. It's just not possible.
But is it possible to be a perfect parent either?
I mean, no.
You hope you've laid the foundation and you hope you've taught them to make good choices.
Right.
And then you send them off.
Yeah, and they're cooked by age six, by the way. By age six, they are cooked.
Is that right?
That's what I believe. I believe whatever you've instilled in them by the time they hit grade one, you know, the kindergarten rules, you know, like say please, say thank you, wash your hands after you go to the bathroom, put the toilet seat down.
I'm still saying that to my son.
But it's the kindergarten rules, right? So they're pretty much cooked by age six.
Let me talk about your first child who wasn't in your world. And I think it was your assistant that came to you and said, David,
somebody's on the phone trying
to reach you saying they may be your daughter.
Right.
Can you share that?
It's a story that's probably been repeated a million times. I mean, not my story, but it's a story that millions of people could tell where, you know, you're young and I was 19 or 20 and had a child with somebody my own age, 19 or 20, and we weren't equipped to be married or be together. So you hold the child for 30 seconds and then all of a sudden somebody takes it and you sign the adoption papers and that's it. And I knew that one day, you know, I would get that call, which was fantastic call.
Was it?
It was great. But the funny thing was, Allison lives in Edmonton in Canada. Mm-hmm. She and her husband, Brent, are huge, and I'm talking major, huge hockey fans. I happened to be in Edmonton the day I met her, and I was with my friend Wayne Gretzky.
Oh, your buddy Wayne?
Yeah. So there we were, Wayne and I, meeting Allison and her husband.
For
the first time, they didn't know where to look. Yes, she was excited to meet her biological father. She was more excited to meet Wayne Gretzky. It's like, Wayne Gretzky, my father. Wayne Gretzky, you're David Foster, my father. She didn't know where to look. And the husband, of course, went right to Wayne.
Yeah. But you have a good relationship with her now and things are good?
It's great, and she's a wonderful girl. Strangely, looks more like me than any of my other children. Honestly, Lillian, I know that having kids isn't for everybody, but I can't imagine my life without my children. It's just like, I don't even know if I'd want to get up in the morning at this point. Contrary to me being here and doing an interview and my career and all that stuff, you know, but it really is what I live for, is for my children to be happy. She's a free and gentle flower. She's a flower growing wild.
That's David Foster in conversation with KVCR's Lillian Vasquez, originally from 2009 when his book Hitman was new, as well as his PBS special. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming.
Unforgettable, that's what you are.
Unforgettable, though near or far.
Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. And all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Back now to Lillian Vasquez in conversation with David Foster, originally from 2009 when his book Hitman was new, as well as his PBS special by the same name.
In your book, you mentioned several artists, and I'm going to go into some of them a little bit. But I really was surprised that not all of them were mentioned. Like, I expected to read more about, I don't know, Elton John. Did you get tired of writing, or did you just say, I can't write about everybody? How did you pick and choose? You kind of tried to save it at the end, like in your acknowledgments.
Yeah. Here's the deal. Well, you know, you really read my book. This interview's over. No, you really did. Here's the thing. My friend Pablo and I wrote the book, and we did it fast because it all kind of just happened. This special, that PBS special, Hitman,
David Foster and Friends.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's kind of my round three where maybe I'm not going to be in the studio with no windows, four walls, making music, sliding under the door. They slide food under. I slide more music under. They slide food. And that's what I've been doing for 35 years. So everybody thought it would be a good idea for the book. I have a friend named Jan Miller, who's a wonderful book agent, and she said, let's just do it and let's get on it. So we got on it and we did it fast.
You did.
And you just reminded me when you said Elton John. I mean, I remember a great story about him that I'm sure I didn't put in the book.
You didn't, because you didn't put
anything.
Is
there no Elton
John story? There was nothing in there about Elton John. Really surprised me.
Okay, so here's the Elton John story.
He's a great piano player.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
And performer, of course.
So he wanted me to be in his band in the 70s, and so I went and auditioned for him. I went to his house. And we went into the garden, and it was just me and Elton walking in the... Now, this is the 70s. Could there be a bigger star in the 70s than Elton John?
He had some big glasses going on then.
It was so... I was so excited to meet him, right? And we talked, and he said, I love the way you play, and I want you to be my piano player, my band. I went, great. And, of course, it got down to money, which I know now that you're not supposed to talk about money. But back then, I didn't know you're not supposed to talk about money right away, right? And so I said, well, how much, you know, am I going to make if I'm starting to be a studio musician? I'm starting to get all this stuff happening, which was true. By the mid-70s, I was getting studio work. Elton said, well, okay, well, what do you want? I said, well, I want $5,000 a week. This is 1974. And he went, thank you very much. This meeting's over. And that was that. I've told him that story since because we're...
Does he remember that story?
No. He doesn't. I mean, we're acquaintances. And he just laughed, so I don't really remember that. But that was it. The meeting was over that second.
Just like that.
Yeah.
And did you learn from that?
Well, I guess I did. That's a good question. I guess I did. I mean, but that's what I was worth. And that's what it would have taken to get me. And thank God I didn't go, because the path that I took was much better suited to where I wanted to go.
All right, let's talk about some of the performers. I don't know if this is when you first worked with her, but when you worked with Natalie Cole and you did the recording with her father, Nat King Cole.
Right.
Tell me about that.
Do you know that record?
Yeah, I'm vaguely familiar with it.
Actually, it was her idea to do the record. It was just a brilliant idea. There was three producers doing the album, including her husband at the time. Mm. We each took seven songs. We went to Dupar's restaurant, the three of us, Tommy LaPuma, Andre Fisher, and I. We put the 21 titles down on the table, and we started picking, like, just, oh, I love that song. Oh, I love, oh, Mona Lisa, I want to do that song. Oh, this one. Yeah. Oh, and I went, Unforgettable. I love that song. I want to do it. I had no idea that she had plans for it to be a duet. I just love the song.
Oh.
So I said, I'll do that. And that was that. And then subsequently after that, she said, oh, by the way, that's the one I want to do with my father. You got to go to Glendale and you got to go get the tape of my father singing it, and you got to make us do a duet together somehow, magically. God, what a great idea this is.
And it was a great idea.
Was it
easy to do?
No,
was
it wasn't easy to do.
A hell of a lot harder than you thought it was going to be?
Yeah, because the technology in the late, early 90s, we didn't have the technology that we have now. So it was a lot of work, but we pulled it off. I think it's a great record.
It is. Let's talk about discovering Celine Dion.
Right. Well, I have to clarify that only because I don't say that I discovered her in the book, because I really didn't, because I brought her to America.
When you met her.
Yeah, is that fair to say that I brought? That's different than discovering, right?
You're David Foster. You could say whatever you want,
yeah,
David.
But if it was just you and I could, but there's going to be people watching. They're going to go phone. They're going, no, he didn't.
No, he didn't. Okay, meeting Celine and bringing her to the U.S.
Yes. Well, she had a career in Quebec, mm-hmm. her local province in Canada.
Really young, wasn't she?
Yeah, she started recording when she was 12.
Yeah.
I stumbled upon her when she was 18 through a friend of mine at the CBC named Carol Reynolds, who sent me a tape of her. And I loved it so much. I couldn't believe this person could really sing like this. So I flew to Montreal. I traveled 100 miles in the rain. And there she was singing in this tent in this kind of family gathering with, I don't know, it was like, I don't know, all I could see was her. When I saw her sing, it's all I could see. And I invited her to come down to Los Angeles. We made the first English album at my studio in Malibu, and I'd take her to all the Malibu spots, and we'd be taking her picture, and of course, nobody knew who she was. And I told her, I said, Celine, one day you're going to be known by your first name only, and Barbra Streisand is going to know who you are, and she's going to love you, and she's going to want to sing with you.
And she loved that because she was a big fan of Streisand.
As you are, too.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah, Barbra was her idol. And so, and I think I talk about it in the book, that when I finally introduced the two of them, which was thrilling for me, too, mm-hmm. and I took Celine and her husband to Barbara's house for dinner, and as Celine reports back to me, she said, you know, that day, I stared at the way she brought the fork to her mouth, and I stared at the way she chewed her food, and I looked at the way she turned her face.
Or how she positions her fingers and her hands and her fingernails.
Oh, Barbra with the beautiful
hands. Everything, with the beautiful,
hands,
yes, and long, yes. Mm-hmm. So she has great memories of that.
Yes, and I know you probably want to talk about it later, but Full Circle is my new artist, Charisse, now from the Philippines, who's in the special, who's 16 years old. Her greatest dream was to meet Celine, so I took her to see...
That was totally Full Circle.
Yeah, totally Full Circle. And then I said, Charisse, Celine's going to know you. You're going to be known by your first name only, and she's going to sing with you. And sure enough, you know, Charisse went to New York. They sang together on stage, and
it was wonderful.
Full Circle.
All right, you brought up Barbra Streisand, so I'm going to as well. You've worked with her, and I guess because you are the hitman, David Foster, you can push her to perform and get away with it, because she tends to be herself a perfectionist, as I've read, I wouldn't know, but perfectionist with, what is it, with purpose. Tell me about that.
I think there's a difference between being a perfectionist and being a perfectionist with purpose, because a perfectionist, I think, is just would constantly be going, no, that's going to be there, that's got to be there, you know, or whatever, whatever in line. But Barbra has an end result to her perfection, and she just simply, well, I'll give you an example. Many times when we're singing, she'll have the lyrics there, and the lyrics will be printed wrong. It'll be an if instead of an and, or a but instead of, or it'll be a spelling mistake, it'll be something. And, you know, she would say, you know, somebody's got to, I want the correct lyric sheet. And I would go, you know, just take your pen and write it in. And she said, no, I want the, you know, and I thought, wow, I mean, why can't she just write the word in herself? But the older I get, the more
like
I,
that?
Yeah, I'm so much like her now. I get it. I totally get it. It's like, why can't it just be right? It just needs to be right, period. And she's right, and she taught me to not like incompetence. She doesn't like it, and she taught me not to like it. And I hate it now. I absolutely hate incompetence. So that was a big lesson I learned.
Well, I've been a great fan of hers for many, many years, since I was in my teens. I would not like to interview her.
You wouldn't?
No.
Oh, she'd be lovely.
No, because I would hate to do what Rosie did when Rosie brought her on and couldn't really, I mean, she's a woman, just like I am, well, to
put
some
your
degree.
Pants on one leg at a time,
I mean,
just
my
like
point.
My mother says. Yeah,
and so, and she feels that way too. You've heard her say, why do you ask these dumb questions, these weird questions?
Does she say that?
Yeah, she has said that in interviews. And so I'd be thinking, gosh, what do I ask that's okay? You know, I've read a couple of her books, so I'd love to admire her from afar. She's
but you're very comfortable, and you're very good at what you do, and you'd probably do great with her. You know why? Because if you're smart, which you are, with somebody like Barbra, all you'd have to do is ask her one question, and you'd get a five-minute answer.
But if you asked her one dumb question, it would really show, because she might say to you, what are you asking that for?
I don't know. If I was interviewing Barbra, I would say something like, why do you seem to prefer gardening over singing?
Yeah, and I would go there.
Yeah.
That's where
because I'd want to know that.
Or I'd compliment her on her husband.
That wouldn't be such a good thing.
No, but
probably
he
not
can't
because
help but compliment. I mean, he's fabulous.
Yeah, he's...
And they look beautiful together.
Yeah, they do.
All right, let's move on from Barbra Streisand.
Her hands got the beautiful hair.
Doesn't she?
Oh, the day I met her.
I know it.
I just
and just the way
love.
She always shaved. Okay, let's move on.
That's David Foster in conversation with KVCR's Lillian Vasquez, originally from 2009. You're listening to KVCR's on 91.9 KVCR. Online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. Again, many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. You can also now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR.
Jackie Collins, Coolest Chick in Town. I thought that was really interesting. I mean, in the 80s, maybe it was the 90s when I was reading many of her books. Mm-hmm. But that's what you called her, the coolest chick in town. Why?
Well, Jackie is not unlike you, by the way. No, she's not. I mean, just like, you know, she's so hip. She can be elegant as hell, and she can be very prim and proper, or she can be one of the guys.
Yeah.
And that, I love that. And she's hot, and she's sexy, and she's, you know, she's in her 50s or 60s or whatever she is, but it just doesn't matter. She's just a great girl. You can tell by the way she writes that she's a great girl.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think so.
She's always smiles, and she'll bust your balls if you're doing something, you know. Foster, why haven't you called me in the last, or whatever, you know.
I like that.
Yeah, you can pick up with her after not seeing her for 2 years. I like that. No pressure in the friendship, you know.
That's great. I want to talk about Paul McCartney. You actually had the opportunity to ask him what millions of people probably would have liked to have asked him, and why'd you guys break up?
It was one of the greatest moments of my life.
Yeah, it had to be.
Yeah, because if you go back to my childhood, as we were talking about earlier, and when I turned 13, I was a classical geek until I heard She Loves You on the radio by the Beatles, and my head went, whoa, what was that? And all of a sudden, Beethoven and Bach were put on hold, but I'd gotten that great 8-year foundation, thankfully, but the Beatles just turned my head around, and Paul was my favorite because he was the more melodic writer. I now, 40 years later, realize John Lennon's huge contribution to the whole thing and his edginess, and I realize how that all worked now. But at the time, it was McCartney all the way for me. So when I got to sit like this at the kitchen table in his house, because the board's not working, we can't work, and he says, ask me anything you want. Who wouldn't want to say,
exactly.
How did you guys break up?
Exactly.
And that's what I asked him. Well, I didn't start there. I went easy.
Did you? You worked your way into it.
Yeah, I asked a little stupid question about George, and then a question about Ringo, and then a question about one of his kids. But I just wanted to get to the meat. And the meat was, why did you guys break up? And then I got the truth.
And what did he tell you?
He said, life is like a crap sandwich. No, he didn't say that. He said, well, we were in a meeting at Apple Records, and we were waiting on John, and we were just going to discuss our next record or tour or whatever, and John walked in with Yoko, and John said, I'm leaving the band, and then they walked out. And then he said, the other three of us turned to each other and did what every other band would do. We said, who can we get? Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, and they started naming other guitar players.
Just like that.
Don't you think that's amazing?
The fact that you got to ask, that he gave you that answer.
I got the straight goods from the man.
And it's really that simple. But when the Beatles do it, it's big stuff.
It's big stuff, but it's just still a band.
It is.
And it's four guys
that lost
a member.
I thought I had read that you almost had the opportunity to bring them all together for an evening just to jam around in Los Angeles. Am I making that up, or did
I
dream that?
I did write about it.
And you started the conversation about it?
It's half-assed. We were over with George and Ringo.
Oh, good, I'm only half wrong.
Yeah. No, but maybe I wasn't clear enough in the book, but my friend Jim Keltner, who I love, was a drummer who the Beatles all loved, because he was such an amazing musician. If there was a fifth Beatle, it probably would have been Jim Keltner, the drummer, because he played on some of the records, and they all loved him. And we were all kicking around one night at George's with George and Ringo, and I said,
George and Ringo were both there?
And I think Jim Keltner said, hey, you know, Paul's in town, and somebody else said, John's in town. I said, George, why don't we just call him up and have him come over? Maybe we can jam a little. And George went, well, that's not a bad idea. And, you know, Ringo, whatever, you know, but it just never happened.
Right. But the idea that it could, and they were all in the same city, would have been really awesome.
I wouldn't have been standing here talking to you today because I would have been still on that cloud, you know, 20 years later.
I want to talk about your car accident with the homeless man.
Right.
Can you tell me that story?
You know, since I've written the book, I haven't really thought about it in 15 years much, thanks in no small part to the man I hit who doesn't really hassle me about it. But, you know, driving home late one night after a session, 2:30 in the morning on PCH, bang, I hit a guy right in the middle of the road. I think he's homeless because he's just a guy in shorts and no t-shirt. And it turns out it's Ben Vereen, the actor, the wonderful actor. Yeah, and I thought I just killed a homeless person. Not that it makes any difference whether he's homeless or
absolutely.
Ben Vereen.
Right.
But it was just a horrible night that I actually, because I was doing a TV show last week, they played the 911 tapes, which I hadn't heard in 15 years. And my voice is truly an octave higher than
you
normal.
I saw it on Dr. Phil.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Right, and it was on Dr. Phil. And your voice was, and you were panicking, and you were shook up. And like you said, it didn't matter that he was a homeless.
No.
You didn't know that. You were just worried that you'd hurt anybody, whoever it was.
I was sure I was killed, hitting with a truck at 50 miles an hour. But he got through it. You know, the helicopters came, they took him away. And
what did he say to you when he was able to talk to you again?
It's part of the reason why I called the book Hitman. 3 months later, when I finally was able to talk to him, I picked up the phone and said, hello. He said, David. Ben, good hit. Can you imagine?
Oh, I can't.
I know. He's such a good man.
All right, let's talk about Kevin Costner. He was not at
You had a crush on Kevin Costner. I can just tell.
He's out of my league. I didn't.
Not exactly.
Oh, he's not?
Well, no. Well, maybe now because he's married.
I actually did interview him once. It was a really quick interview. It was on a baseball field. It was here in San Bernardino.
What did you ask him?
Oh, I don't know, something stupid. Right. Because I was the leading reporter. I was doing the questions. Everyone had their mic out there, but I was the one asking the questions. But I remember thinking what a thrill it was to interview him.
He's quite charismatic.
A little bit.
Yeah.
It's carried him a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you know, we met under my friend Richard Baskin introduced us. We went boating together in Canada. And he said, you know, I'm really tired. I've just been working on this movie. And we said, what's it called? He said, it's a Western called Dances with Wolves. I mean, he's just like, he's such a low-key guy. And he completely downplayed it. And then he said, but I'd like to invite you to the premiere. We thought, oh, we'll never hear from him again. And sure enough, we got an invite. And that led to him saying, you know, I'm working on this new movie with Whitney Houston called The Bodyguard. It's a script that's been kicking around for 15 years. I think it's going to be great. You know, I think Whitney can act. And we want you to do the music. And you just never know. You see, that's the thing about life is you just don't know what, I mean, somebody could have a CD that they hand me on my way out. And, you know, I just, 9 times out of 10, wouldn't even play it. But this time, I'm just going to play it. I stick it in the car, and I hear the song, and I go, man, that'd be perfect for my new girl, Cherise. You just never know what's going to happen. That little boat trip in Canada where I just accepted a couple of people that needed a boat for a while, I didn't even know it was Kevin Costner. And that turns out to be Kevin Costner, and then I'm doing The Bodyguard, and it's probably the most important project I've done in my life, I think.
Yeah, I think you said you had a nice royalty check from that one.
Yeah, that's true.
It was gorgeous. Yeah. And working with Whitney Houston.
She's like a locomotive. I mean, I've seen everything, singing-wise. You know, you have to be a bit of a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a mother, a father, a brother, a sister when you're producing records, because my job is to get the greatest vocal possible out of this person, a better vocal than any other person can do in the world. That's my job in my mind, right? Mm-hmm. There's a ton of record producers out there that are really good. I want to be the one that gets you to sing better than anybody else got you to sing. That's my job in my mind.
I think that's the job in their mind, too, when they have with you, because everyone who's talked about you, that's what they all say. He'll push you, and he'll push you, and he'll push you. And you don't mind doing it because it's David Foster asking you to do it, which you know he has a good ulterior motive.
But to the point of being like Celine called me once. She said I was contemptuous, cold and contemptuous when I was making her sing the high note and all by myself 10 times. I read it in her book.
Oh.
So, but, you know.
But Whitney.
So I've seen everything on the mic. I've seen people walk up and they go, me, and the vocal coach is there, and they're warming up for 2 hours, and then they get up to the night and they go, nah, I don't feel like it today. You know, let's try it again tomorrow. I've just seen everything, right? Mm-hmm. Lemon, this and that, and the doctor. Oh my God, Whitney, like a locomotive. She's like a racehorse. Like, bang, take the jacket off, get up to the mic, and go, and not stop till it's done. Celine's like that too.
Is she?
Yeah, it's amazing. And the thing is, somewhere along the line, and I'm not speaking out of school because I watched the program of Whitney and Bobby, somewhere along the line, she got off track. She didn't take care of her voice. And now she's paying the price for that. And we don't know what the end result will be. We don't know how that voice will, it should be able to come back.
God willing it will.
Yeah, God willing it will.
She's a wonderful, wonderful talent to Hollywood.
Amazing talent.
Yeah.
Super. And she needs to, you know, she just got off track.
You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past shows are at iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Briefly now, before we go back to Lillian Vasquez in conversation with David Foster, reminding you again that KVCR will once again be partnering with Feeding America, Riverside San Bernardino, for our Feed Your Radio, Feed Your Family campaign, during which we'll be looking for listener contributions with a really nice benefit in that every dollar person contributes during this short campaign means another meal for someone in need here in the Inland Empire. A $10 contribution, that's 10 meals. A $100 contribution, 100 meals. Again, this short drive is coming up in the second week of December. That'll be one day and one morning, December 11th and 12th. Now back to KVCR's Lillian Vasquez in conversation with David Foster. Originally from 2009, speaking about his book, Hitman, his PBS special, and more.
All right, let's talk about some of the PBSers, like finding and playing the music of Josh Groban.
Are you familiar with Josh Groban?
A little bit. He's pretty big on PBS.
Well. Yeah, he's right in that zone, isn't he?
Yes. How did that happen?
I have these.
Somebody give you something on that one?
Yeah, there's a wonderful vocal coach named Seth Riggs, who's well known in Los Angeles, and I needed somebody to sound like Andrea Bocelli. For an Oscar.
Right, he filled in.
He filled in.
That's right.
And so Seth sent me this tape, and these voices were just like, they were good, but they were just like these big, wide vibratos. You know, Bocelli has this thing the fourth singer is the 17-year-old, and he's singing All I Ask of You from The Phantom. I'm going, Jesus, it's like the Celine moment again, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And I said, I got to get this kid to my studio. I got him out of his parents drove him out to the studio. He's still in high school. I said, tomorrow morning you're going to be singing with Celine Dion at the rehearsal for the Oscars.
And he said?
He said, I can't do that song. It's too high for me. I said, no, you're going to do that song, and you're going to do it in this key, and it's going to be fine. And he came, and he did, and he conquered. And
wow.
The start of a beautiful... It's been 10 years.
I
can't believe it. It's been 10 years. He's super talented, and he's got so much to offer in so many different arenas. He's not just that voice. He's a really good piano player. He's a really good songwriter. He's a good drummer. He loves all kinds of music, which I didn't know at the time. I had no idea. It was just a voice for me. You know, something that I could push around when he was 17 or 18. He'd say, do this, do this, do that. But he's a man now with on a mission, and I think he's going to bring more great music to the world in the next decade.
All right, Andrea Bocelli. Meeting him, working with him. I did see the one concert in Los Angeles where he performed. Actually, you brought in Paul Anka also, which I really enjoyed Paul Anka.
Was that at the Hollywood Bowl, by
it
any chance?
It was at the
Hollywood Bowl. Yeah, that's right.
Is my memory okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
I met him in New York the first time, and I tell you, Lillian, I've been so lucky because I get to work with great singers. I mean, I've planned it that way, too. I don't want to work with bad singers.
Does anybody?
Well, a lot of okay singers make great hit records.
Oh, okay. I see where you're going.
I mean, like, let's take Britney Spears, for instance, just to get off track for just one second.
That's okay.
She makes amazing records. She just can't do the acrobatics that I want her to do if I was to ever get her on a mic. But she's incredible. I mean, she makes great records. I just don't want any part of that. I don't know how to do it.
Oh, I see.
I love listening to it from afar. I think her new song, Womanizer, is fantastic. The song Circus, the new album, is great. She's going to have a huge, huge comeback career.
Good.
But I get to work with great singers mostly. You know, Mariah, Natalie Cole, Barbara, Whitney, Celine, Michael Bolton, Groban, Buble, Bocelli. I mean, these are the greatest singers. Having said that, where I'm going with this is, with all due respect to everybody on that list, and they're all A+, Bocelli is my favorite because there's something, like Celine said, if God could have had a voice, it would be Andrea Bocelli. Mm. There's something about him when I'm with him that makes me feel like I'm with Mozart or Beethoven.
Back to your classical days.
Exactly. It takes me back to my classical days. And with all the greatest respect to every singer that I worked with, and they're all amazing, he gives me this connection like that's the closest I'm ever going to get to that genius of Bach or Beethoven. Because the guy... His opera repertoire is incredible. His repertoire is so huge, and the guy's blind. I mean, he can't read music, and he's learned probably 40 arias. It's just amazing. His knowledge is so vast, and he's a Renaissance man. He loves to windsurf, he loves to go boating, he loves to ride horses, he loves to golf, he loves to run.
He loves to golf?
Yeah, he does it all. He does everything. He does everything.
Okay.
And he, I know, it's weird. He can sit at the piano and play an Elvis Presley song, or he can sit and play Ave Maria. Play it perfectly and sing it perfectly.
And you had him sing. I don't know if you had him sing, but he sang an Elvis song at that concert, which was fabulous.
Yeah, wasn't
it great?
Well, I mean,
it was awesome to listen to Andrea Bocelli sing an Elvis song.
The concept
was
of that,
cool.
But we were in Vegas.
Is that where it was?
That was in Vegas. Well, if you're talking about the Amore...
When I just know that he sang an Elvis song, and I thought it was really cool.
Why?
Yes,
man. He's sitting at the piano. It's just
great.
Like too cool for the
it
room.
It is great. Records 143, mm-hmm. Your own label. Why the 143? Is that an address?
It's 143, and it's just one letter, four letters, three letters. I love you.
Oh.
Cute. And it was corny, right? Everybody, my kids said, that's really corny. Then the rappers started using it to end their texts. 143.
Is that right?
And all of a sudden, I became hip.
Ooh. Again.
Again. Yeah, for the third time.
I know you enjoy working with superstars. Otherwise, you've spent your career working with superstars. But you also enjoy finding either raw talent, new talent, and the young ones, and maybe taking them on their own path. Tell me about that.
It's something that I wish I had done more of in my life, because it's so rewarding in ways that producing Whitney is not.
Just different.
Yeah, because you take Josh, for instance. This happened right from the very second of gestation, of that first day in my studio with his parents driving me there. And then I see him now, and I see him packing arenas all over the world. And to know that I was part of the journey the whole way. I mean, let's be honest. The Bodyguard was great. But, you know, Whitney Houston had a lot of hits before me. And she had hits after me, too.
Yes.
And so that's thrilling to a point. This is like real
stuff.
Creation, you know. And the same about with Michael Bublé. which probably is next on your
list. Actually, Michael is not on my
list. Why?
He's not on my list because he's Canadian. We don't want to talk about another Canadian, do we? Just kidding. No, he's not on my list. I was going to talk about Charisse.
Yes.
She's new. She's found her. Now, did you find her through YouTube? Were you watching it? Or did Miss Oprah help you along there?
I can't even remember exactly the way it all came about, but two people, including my sister James and a fellow named Perry Watts Russell at Warner Brothers Records, a guy who I highly respect, within 10 minutes of each other emailed me a link to her YouTube site. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know which one of them to give credit if it went any further than that. I watched it. I was blown away. And then I think Ellen had her on her show, and Oprah saw her on Ellen.
Ellen had her before Oprah?
You know,
you better get that right, Mr.
I know.
Foster.
I can't. I think we need to look this up before we... You need to edit this part out.
Before we go any further.
Well, anyway, whatever happened, Oprah fell in love with her, and Oprah and her executive producer, Lisa Erzbommer, who's a wonderful mm-hmm. girl, they called me together. You know, a call from Oprah is like,
oh,
come on.
Yeah. You take that call, do you?
Oprah. And, you know, she really, truly loves... They love this girl and have made it a mandate for themselves. They want to protect her. They want to make sure everything gets done right for her. They basically put her in my charge musically. Mm-hmm. And it's a big responsibility because with somebody like Charisse, she can do so many different things. She hasn't found her own voice yet. Sort of like Celine, because when I saw Celine, she was doing nothing but cover songs. I think the first song I saw Celine do was I Will Survive.
Oh.
First I was afraid, you know, she's out there,
just
had no idea what she was singing because mm-hmm. she didn't speak English. And Charisse is kind of in that thing too, so we have to find
her voice.
And that may take a year. Mm-hmm. That may take 2 years. But we're going to go slow at it. You know.
But in the meantime, the voice that she's using right now with the songs, they sound fabulous. I mean, she's singing like Celine.
Yes.
I mean, that's kind of the songs that
she's got to remember singing. That, and this is not to take anything away from Charisse, because she is spectacular, and I really think she's going to be the next superstar. And I always, for the last 5 years, I believed that the next superstar was going to be Asian. I don't know why. I just thought, wow, there's 1.5 billion of you. There's got to be somebody.
And she's from the Philippines, is she not?
She's from the Philippines, yeah. And the whole country is just so excited about her. I mean, the Oprah connection.
When I saw her perform in Vegas at Hitman, David Foster and Friends, blown away. Never heard of her.
Right, but the point I was going to make, Lillian, is that you have to be very careful when you're picking who you think is going to be the next superstar, because those songs are already superstars. The songs themselves are superstars.
Right.
And you've probably been somewhere in your life where somebody is saying, I Will Always Love You, at a karaoke bar, and they're half decent, and the place goes crazy.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the thing you got to be...
I see.
Now, Charisse has the goods, but we need to find songs that nobody knows
and make them her songs,
right. And then get people to be crazy about those songs.
Right.
So that's my mission, and it's a big one.
What do you tell young artists? What do you advise them? Based on from where you are now to when you first started in this business, and the business has changed, mm-hmm. I'm guessing.
Yeah.
What do you tell young artists when they have that desire, and you can see it, and they have the talent? What do you tell them?
I want to address that in two ways. One, because the business has changed. I don't want to address that. But I think there's no better advice that I can give than how I've conducted my own life, you know? I mean, it's an oversimplification to say, don't do drugs, don't drink, work hard, stay up late, work weekends, you know? I mean, I always worked weekends because I always felt if I wasn't, somebody else was,
right? Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, basically my life style is a pretty good template for success, I think. So there's that. And then as far as the business changing, I like to tell singers that, I mean, the music business is difficult, but the only reason the music business is difficult for me now is because I'm almost 60. So I have to work twice as hard now as I did when I was 30 to have success, because it's a young person's world and business.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm trying to think like a young person, and it's very difficult, but I'm up for the challenge. I don't like these kind of people that go, oh, I hated the music business. I had to get out, man. The music business sucks. It's just awful. It's not true. The music business left them. They didn't leave the music business. And I'm determined that the music business will not leave me. I'm going to stay in as long as I can. And, you know, business, the only thing constant is change, and you know, and I'm constantly morphing. Like my friend Ronnie Hawkins said, when you come up against a brick wall, you know, if you keep doing that, you're not going to go anywhere. But if you just go around it, find a different way.
Works a little better.
It'll work. So I guess that would be two things I'd want to pass along to anybody. I mean, you got to eat and breathe. You didn't get in that chair by doing a lot of drugs and wandering off the path too far. You couldn't. It's impossible to get to that chair without that. I know that you must have worked day and night and worked weekends and swept the floor and you
did a few toilets too.
Yeah,
anybody.
I'm sure you did. I mean, like, what? There's great dignity in flipping burgers if you know you're going to own the joint one day.
That's right.
Right?
Absolutely.
So, like a singer comes to me and says, oh, you know, my dad won't pay for me to go in the studio, but I really want to make a record and I got these songs. I say, well, go get a job sweeping the floor in the studio. Start there. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, somebody's going to let you in that room and you're going to make
Find
friends with the second engineer, and he's going to be able to record your voice, and you know.
Right, right.
Find a way.
Absolutely. Okay, who would you still like to work with? I know you said in your book, Sting is on your top five.
Right.
But you didn't say who the other four were.
Well,
you
just said
he's in your top five.
All right, let me see if I can think of four of them. Stevie Wonder, because I think there's another great
album.
You've
not worked with Stevie
Wonder. No, and I think there's a great album in him, and I think he needs to be reminded of his greatness.
Okay.
I love Chris Martin, and I think I'll never work with him because he doesn't want to work with me, I'm sure, from Coldplay. But I think that Coldplay makes amazing music that I can relate to. So, I don't know, the possibility of him and I sitting and writing a song together would be fascinating for me, maybe boring for him. But that's three.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay, that's all right.
Three's good. Can I get back to you on the other
two? Yeah, I would like
that. Who would you like to see me work with?
Well, one of my favorites, and I don't know how it would work, but I love Billy Joel.
Now, that's interesting.
Love Billy Joel, but I don't know how that would go.
Well, it would work good because Billy is a guy that needs to be reminded of his greatness.
And I agree with that 100%.
So I would say, like I did with Chicago in the 80s, when they were struggling and didn't remember how great they were and were writing these songs that were not good, and I got them back on track again, you know, and I would say to Billy, remember this song? And then I'd play Allentown, or I'd play, you know, Don't Go Change, right? Yeah, and I'd say, now, just write a song like that. I'll take care of the rest. It'd be a good combination.
Yeah, I think. And can I take credit for it if it works?
It's on film.
Okay.
That's David Foster in conversation with KVCR's Lillian Vasquez. Originally from 2009 when his book Hitman was new, as well as the first time we were airing his PBS special by the same name. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. Many past shows are at iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts.
All right, let's talk about the David Foster Foundation.
Mm.
What is it and what is it doing?
We are a foundation that are Canada only. We started in my hometown of Victoria, British Columbia. There was a niche that we found taking care of the families of children that need organ transplants, not paying for the surgeries, but paying for everything else. Mm-hmm. At that time, 23 years ago, families had to travel from British Columbia down to either Loma Linda here in California or Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to get their transplant done.
Right.
It meant building a whole second home and a whole second life. The siblings got left behind. Mm-hmm. New apartment here, a second car. The father had to stay home with the other children, or the mother had to stay home. It was just this financial burden that was impossible for these families to deal with. We found that niche and we filled it first in British Columbia, and about 3 years ago we went nationwide. And in Canada, that's coast to coast to coast, meaning the Arctic Ocean as well. And we've helped kids in every province and the two territories and Eskimo children, and it's just fantastic.
You've met some of these families as well?
Tons of them.
Have you?
Tons of them.
And what has that meant for you? Kind of hard? Gratifying?
Well, it's kind of ineffable. I have so many stories of letters that I've gotten and credit where I shouldn't have gotten credit because it's a huge base of people that helps. But the fact of the matter is, when a father holds his child, when I go to Toronto, it's a kids' hospital in Toronto, mm-hmm. and a father holds his child, Noah, I'm thinking of in particular this baby, but the story is dozens and hundreds of times, and he goes, you see this? And you see my wife and I? We're together because of you. If it wasn't for you, we would be divorced. I mean, it's just insane. I had lunch a couple of months ago with this girl, Katie Luxton, who's 27, beautiful girl. She was 7 when she got her heart transplant. She was one of the first families we helped.
Awesome.
She's 27 and breaking hearts now. She's really, really
great
cute,
story.
Adorable, and 20 years later, and she's like, she will always have a connection to me and to my foundation, always, always for helping them.
That's cool.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about Hitman.
Thanks for asking about that, by the way.
David Foster and Friends, my pleasure. You were great as a host.
Yeah.
And not only did you, I mean, when they watch the show, when our audience is watching the show, they're seeing 2 hours of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I was in the audience. I was fortunate.
It was long.
4 hours of performance.
I know.
And you were flawless as a host. I mean, you moved things along. I mean, I saw your teleprompter, and I kept watching it just to see if you were, and you would.
I only used it three times.
You would say, or it felt like you did.
I didn't want a teleprompter, by the way, but they thought there's certain things I had to get to.
Right, that you have to say, and I understand. And same thing, when I'm in Pledge, I like to ad lib just because I'd rather ad lib.
Right.
But you were flawless in that, and you did a great job moving and entertaining that audience for 4 hours.
Well, thanks.
And that's quite a talent. You had wonderful talent there that night.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
The list was enormous.
17 artists.
And to get them all there in one night to perform for PBS to benefit and millions of others obviously watching the show and to benefit from. But it was wonderful.
Yeah, and to that point about PBS public television, it needs to go on record as saying that I grew up on public television. I know that it's been around for 53 years. My children grew up on it. We were there. Public television was there long before the History Channel, the Discovery Channel, and all the other. I mean, it's just a place where you can always go and it's safe. It's educational, it's entertaining, and it's a safe place to go. No, you don't need any locks for your children, no matter how young or old they are. And all these artists, these 17 artists, did this concert for free. Yes, if the DVD sells a lot, there'll be a royalty at some point way down the road. But we all did it for free, and I swear to you, I was focused on public television. I knew that this was the place where it was going to get the attention that could help raise money for public broadcasting, and it's really important work. I mean, yeah, sure, okay, I'm on camera, and that's all great and all that, and it was fun to do that. And how hard could it be, really, to introduce the likes of Peter Cetera and Boss Gags and Josh Groban and Brian McKnight and Kenny G?
It's great stuff.
You know, I mean, it's just not that difficult, and it's where I'm most comfortable. I'm much more comfortable at the piano than I am here in this chair. If there was a piano here...
And I thought that about you, and that's why I said I think you did a great job hosting it, because you were out front. I mean, you were at the piano, too.
Yeah.
But you were out front
in my
bringing
element,
on these artists.
Oh, I mean, fabulous. Would you have trouble introducing those people? I mean...
Yeah. Heck yes.
Oh, you would?
Oh, yeah. Oh. I mean, come on.
Well,
yes, I would.
I was focused on public television. I'm not kidding, because I think it's just a great platform for that kind of show. I wish I could do that every week as a variety show, like the Ed Sullivan Show, for those of you that are really old. But who knows?
I don't watch American Idol. So I didn't know some of the artists. Mm. And was it Catherine McPhee?
McPhee, mm-hmm.
When she came on and sang, not only did she look stunning, but when she sang a song that, Somewhere, didn't she sing Somewhere?
Yes. Doesn't that take a lot of...
Yeah, yeah, because Streisand had sang the Somewhere song, and she sang it, and then she performed with Bocelli.
Yeah.
I mean, was she nervous? Was she just...
I think
was she in her element? How was that for her?
She's a very confident young woman. Mm-hmm. She's movie star gorgeous, and has a voice as good as anybody I've ever worked with. Mm-hmm. And I think she's very comfortable, and Bocelli loves her.
Does
you
he?
Can see. I mean, he just...
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
But I was thinking I was reading more.
No,
into,
didn't like, they have nice chemistry?
That's what I thought, too. Yes,
yeah.
I definitely
And he's
was
got a girlfriend.
That.
She's got a husband.
Right,
all that's
right,
good.
Right,
but
right. But it doesn't matter. I mean, we're just talking about on camera. They seem to work well together.
Absolutely.
And sometimes you can see when artists don't work as well together.
Yeah.
And it's pretty
but
obvious.
But not that night.
No. Everything was beautiful.
No, Catherine is a force. She's wonderful. And also Michael Johns was the other American Idol.
Right.
He was the top 10 finalist, number 7, I think. And he's making his first album right now. Catherine's making her second album. They both have huge, bright futures, I think, you know.
Yeah, it was just a wonderful, magical night. And I was real curious to see how David Horn was going to bring 4 hours into 2 hours.
And then into 83 minutes for the pledge.
Yeah, I mean, because how do you cut out, I mean, some of the songs you had to cut out. I mean, it was easy to cut some of your stuff while you were talking because you were just entertaining for the time.
Like the heckler that I had, remember the heckler?
Yes, I do. Yeah, and you talked about your many wives.
Yes.
But it was really nice to see what they came up with after that 4-hour performance, and I was really curious
about
that.
The one thing that I was really disappointed that I had to cut out of the PBS show that's on the DVD is my artist, Renee Olstead, who is a young 18-year-old gal who came and sang a song that I co-wrote called Through the Fire that Chaka Khan had a hit with. And she's just wonderful. Her album's coming out very, very soon, and she's amazing. And somehow it ended up 3 minutes. That's the 3 minutes that's got to go, and I didn't really have a say in it, and I'm really bummed about that. So I'm apologizing to you, Renee.
You'll make it up to her.
But you're on the DVD. Everybody should just see the DVD. And
you'll make it up to her, I'm sure. Even through the fire. Thank you so much.
Renee Olstead. Wow.
For the entirety of tonight's KVC Arts, it's been Lillian Vasquez in conversation with the hitman, David Foster. One more reminder, on December 11th and 12th, one day and the following morning, KVCR will be partnering with Feeding America Riverside San Bernardino for our Feed Your Radio, Feed Your Family campaign. This is a very brief campaign where, as we look for listener contributions, every dollar raised provides a meal for someone in need here in the Inland Empire. If you can give $5 or $10, that's 5 or 10 meals. $25, 25 meals. $100, 100 meals for someone in need here in our listening area. Again, that'll be December 11th and 12th, and we hope to hear from you. Thanks again to David Foster and here at KVCR. Thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Benjamin Perper, and an extra thanks going to Sharina Watt. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts are composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, and NPR One, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.